The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Out of hours, GP services are now almost at breaking point as patients turn to them to avoid overcrowded hospitals. Meanwhile, a new COVID strain is here. I'm joined on the line by Professor of Immunovirology at UCC, Liam Fanning, and by Dr. Mel Bates, Medical Director at EDOC and DDOC. Good morning and welcome to you both. Mel, we'll start with you. You might explain how your service works, because in theory, you could be serving a hell of a lot of people.
Well, we are already, without it being in theory, Pat, DDOC and EDOC combined covers 1 million of the population in Dublin. We would have 150,000 face-to-face consultations a year. And we are, you know, we already expect and gear up in September for the busy Christmas period, about 10 days to 2 weeks. And it looks like this year that's going to be stretched out to maybe 5 or 6 weeks or maybe longer.
Mm. Now, how does it work? I mean, do you have physical infrastructure or are you an on-call service?
So we have 8 treatment centres. There's 5 in North Dublin in DDOC and 3 in EDOC in South Dublin. There are other GP out of hours services in South Dublin, so there's more treatment centres besides that. We would have a call takers who takes your demographics, and then you're passed over to a triage nurse who would decide what level of urgency is required for your particular appointment. And then normally you get a treatment centre appointment for the vast majority, or we do have a home visiting service as well for those people who need it. But that's mainly for the very elderly.
Now, what are the costs for a service like this to the patient?
Gosh. Well, it's free to medical card patients, and it's between 65 and 70 euros for private patients. So it's not very much beyond the daytime level of charge. But you know, we recognise that people get ill urgently, you know, out of hours when their own GP isn't available. And their own GPs, by the way, I mean 90 to 95% of daytime GPs are involved in these services. And in fact, over the last 10 days of Christmas, we had 70% of the membership doing an extra out of hour shift. And we've now, this week, we're doubling that for the next couple of weeks. Mm.
So is your doctor cohort made up of doctors who have an involvement in other practices, or do you have dedicated EDOC and DDOC medics?
Well, I think our medics are very dedicated, but they're all local GPs. So that's the basis of the quality of out of hours, that you have experienced local GPs who know the networking, who know how to interact with hospitals locally. And we do have some excellent sessional GPs as well. But they, numerically speaking, they would be the minority, and the majority of shifts done in out of hours would be done by local GPs.
Now, you are pretty much overwhelmed at the moment. What sort of rates of call are you getting? Can you respond to everyone who needs you?
Well, that's what's worrying us, to be honest with you, Pat, at the moment. You know, now things have actually settled down last night and the night before, but that might be just a little blip, if you like. We've had so many people needing our services that we've been maxed out at on occasion. So 2 nights ago, we had 27 patients coming in to see one doctor from midnight until 8 o'clock in the morning, and we had to ask one of the other doctors to stay on for an extra 2 or 3 hours. And we are very appreciative of that. That's in the middle of the night for GP-type consultations, which is very, very rare and very unusual.
The kind of conditions that are presenting at EDOC and DDOC, are we looking at the worried somewhat unwell, or are we looking at the seriously unwell?
Well, we're looking at both, and anytime any doctor or nurse gets on the airways and talks about this, our fear is that the people who will listen to us when we say, you know, maybe consider self-care are the wrong people, okay? But it's precisely because so many people are so ill in the last couple of weeks, and it's a sort of concentration. It's not that it's never happened before, but it's just in a very concentrated form at the moment. They really are ill. They do deserve to see a GP. The trouble is that there's a lot of people who seem to have forgotten the basic message of COVID, which is that this is a viral illness, stay at home, antibiotics won't work, take your paracetamol, know that you're going to take 7 or 8 days to get better with this. And by the way, most most of the illnesses that people have at the moment between RSV and influenza are viral, and antibiotics won't make them better faster. So, and that's a big problem. People's expectations about antibiotics have really gone through the roof at the moment, and it's unfortunate because as a GP, I've been a GP now for 35 years, and in the last 5 years, the public have really got this message that most of these illnesses are viral. Antibiotics won't make any difference to them, and you know, and it was easy to sell that message. I was talking to a GP recently, and she said she'd just given up. She'd given everybody antibiotics because she was having so much grief over not giving them. Yeah. And it's our job as GPs to try and protect antibiotics for future generations. You know, so I suppose that's the main thing. There's a lot. Self-care was there in COVID times. There's excellent resources in undertheweather.ie or mychild.ie, which hopefully, I mean, people need to be reassured, and particularly with children, they need reassurance, and they may well need to see a doctor. But a lot of stuff is available on these websites. There's very good GP videos to reassure people that they're doing fine with their child and there's nothing more serious, if you like.
Okay, you might reiterate those websites again.
Undertheweather.ie, that's a HSE website.
Yeah.
And mychild.ie.
Mychild.ie. Now, it is possible, of course, to develop some sort of post-viral bacterial infection, isn't it?
It is. And, Pat, I prescribe antibiotics every day of my working life. You know, I'm not anti-antibiotics. It's just the expectation that the public have that this is somehow going to make it better just needs to be nudged a little bit. And it's as if people have unlearned this because they definitely had got that message before COVID and they got it through COVID, but specifically for COVID. And I don't know, maybe it's just it's they've had enough of it. They had COVID for 2 years. By the way, the healthcare workers have had enough of it as well for 2 years. And now they have influenza and RSV is beginning to quieten down a little bit. But, you know, it's our job as GPs to make an assessment about whether or not a patient will benefit and get better faster with antibiotics. If they are likely to, then that's fine. For instance, sore throats are 85% viral. Okay, I'll be wrong in 15% of the time. So sometimes I'll cover that with an antibiotic, and sometimes I'll say, listen, if you're not getting better in a couple of days, here's a safety net, if you like. Whereas now, I really have to struggle to try and bring that message across because people have a huge expectation for whatever reason.
One of the worries, of course, with a shortage of drugs like amoxicillin, that you give someone a prescription and say, look, if you really need it, go fill it. And they're hearing on radio that there's a shortage of amoxicillin. So they say, oh, I'll fill it now anyway. And then it goes into the cupboard and is not used.
You know, ours used for the first cousin in 6 months' time. And we're well used to that. Very often we'll write dispense within 1 week or whatever just to. And you're quite right. People may be hedging their bets a little bit. The actual supply of antibiotics is there. It's just sometimes the actual antibiotic that I prescribe as a GP may not be available in a particular pharmacy or even in the surrounding pharmacies, and that creates some difficulty.
Now, we heard during the early phases of the COVID epidemic, we heard about antivirals and the development of antivirals. I mean, are there antivirals available for flu, for indeed COVID, for RSV?
Well, yes, there is. The antivirals for flu, the way it works is that there are GP sentinel practices throughout the country and they feed in information centrally to the number of cases of flu-like illnesses. And that happens every week of the year. And then it goes over a certain threshold at which point they recommend antivirals. Now, we're at that point for the last 5 or 6 weeks or longer. I can't remember exactly when that change happened. The only thing I would say to you is that while it's perfectly appropriate to give these, at the most, you might reduce the length of suffering by maybe 1 day. And the primary use of antivirals is a public health measure to try and reduce the number of people who get sick and then end up in hospital. And then when you talk about the antiviral for the Paxlovid is the antiviral for COVID, that is really very complicated. And it's something that I, as medical director, would caution doctors using in an antiviral setting, because we wouldn't know enough about the patient and exactly what medication they were on, what their renal function was like and all that sort of stuff. And these are very significant interactions. People are always talking about, oh, will this new medication fight with my current medication or whatever? And at the very least, it might make you feel nauseated. And most of the time, it doesn't have any impact. Whereas this is a very significant list of side effects. So it's a very complicated process to put people on it. We are putting it on people on Paxlovid and the treatment for COVID, you know, in the correct age groups. And it does seem to be making some sort of impact, but it's quite a complicated one and best reserved, I think, for the daytime.
I should ask you about the ratio of, you know, who's coming into you with flu, who's coming into you with COVID, who's coming into you with RSV, which is the most troublesome in terms of numbers at the moment?
I think flu, probably. And by the way, you know, most GP practices now have systems for acute same-day appointments. So they have a list of appointments that they don't release until 9 o'clock that morning in order to be dealing with, you know, the acute illness type stuff and the diabetic review, you know, and the prevention of medicine that we do. We're sort of shelving that for a few weeks in favor of the acute illness. So it's mainly probably influenza. And then, as you say, some of those, a certain percentage will become bacterial or else may spark off a tendency towards wheeziness. There's a dreadful spasmodic cough that goes with it, and we occasionally need to treat that with inhalers or steroids.
And finally, one of our listeners says, how does DDoc, EDoc make sense? They take doctors from doctor surgeries and move them to other locations. Why don't existing doctors' surgeries just extend their opening hours?
Well, there is a scheme at the moment funded by the HSE for just that, and that just came in the last week or two, Pat. But interestingly, quite a number of GPs are saying, first of all, everybody, the GPs, the receptionists, the practice nurses, and everybody in healthcare are flat out at the moment. And it's a big ask to ask the extra staff, your practice staff, to stay on much later. So one of the things that the GPs have been doing is say, okay, actually, I know you need extra GPs and extra shifts and out of hours in these next couple of weeks. So therefore, you know, it might be easier for us to do it, give our contribution that way, rather than in the daytime surgery. But remember, they're already arranging those acute appointments anyway and shifting the appointments around in order to better look after the population.
Mel, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Dr. Mel Bates, Medical Director of EDoc and DDoc. Listening to that conversation, Professor of Immunovirology at UCC, Liam Fanning. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, you've heard from the coalface there, literally handling all of these viruses in the doctor's surgery, and then people waking up to hear there's another variant about. What can you tell us reassuringly about this new variant?
Well, I suppose, first of all, compliments to the doctor and the wonderful scheme that he's running there and dealing with all those patients. So this particular variant, look, it's like the variants we've had before, Pat. This is a new kid on the block with respect to Europe, not so much in the United States. It was identified first in New York in October, and over the course of a very short number of weeks, rose to about 40% of the cases. And it's predicted by the end of January that this particular variant has a name of XBB 1.5, will be about 75% of the cases. But, you know, reassuringly enough, WHO or any of the organisations haven't flagged that it's giving any more of a kind of an infectious kind of pattern than we have seen with some of the other variants that we have. In other words, most people are able to manage it. Those that are in the kind of immunocompromised kind of sensitive category are getting unwell as they would. So, you know, it's part of the kind of smorgasbord of kind of variants that we're seeing at the moment. Whether it rises to kind of dominate in Europe or not remains to be seen. That won't happen for a number of weeks if it's going to happen at all. You know, it's at such a low percentage, although it is in about 13 European countries identified at the moment, about 28 countries worldwide. So it is quite likely over February and March that this particular variant could dominate worldwide. Yeah. But reassuringly, the disease profile doesn't seem to be any different from the Omicron variants that we've had in the past.
Now, lots of people have reported getting COVID, including myself, before Christmas, not particularly ill from it, had all the boosters available, the bivalent booster and so on. So the question is, how many of us might have had this, and because we've never hospitalised, never had to see a doctor, therefore not genomically sequenced, many of us might have had this thing.
It's quite possible, because we're only actually sequencing a very small amount. But nonetheless, on the average, if you look across Europe, it's still at a very low prevalence. So it is likely that Ireland is no different, if it may be even a little bit behind some of the European countries. So, you know, we're all dealing with Omicron variants, BAQ1 and so on. So, at the moment, it doesn't seem to matter what variant you're getting, because the disease profile when you get it is actually quite similar, Pat. So it's important from a molecular virology perspective to be tracking this and to know where they are around the world, and in case there's a signal with respect to enhanced disease progression or a more active disease when you get it. But for the most part, the variant that you get really is sort of irrelevant at the moment, because the disease profile is the same. So, again, reassuringly, you've got your COVID, you're fine for a couple of months, you more than likely won't pick up
the
next
one. So the boosters and having had COVID, that should offer protection to people in that situation. I remember Luke O'Neill saying that if you've got all the boosters available and you've had COVID, you're kind of as bulletproof as you can be. No more than that.
You're not protected from being infected, but certainly your trajectory with regard to your disease progression is best got through vaccination, and ironically enough, through some infection as well. Most people in this country and in Europe and the globe probably have been infected at some point over the last two and a half years. Do you know what I mean? So, we have some baseline immunity topped up by our vaccines.
Vaccines important. No vaccine against RSV, it would appear at the moment.
Right.
Certainly there's a flu vaccine there, and many people have availed of it. They're trying to encourage children to avail of it, because whatever about COVID not affecting young children as badly as it might affect others, I presume the flu is a bad dose for everybody.
It is, and if you've ever got it, Pat, you'll know you're kind of floored for about 3 to 5 days. And if you get your vaccine, your duration of disease is shorter. Like, what we're seeing at the moment is what's called extraordinary high levels in most age groups. It's starting to decrease in the less than 15-year-olds. That is the rate of influenza per 100,000. But interestingly enough, in those over 65, it's actually only peaking at the moment into those kind of really high extraordinary levels. So while the rates of other viral infections are decreasing, the amount of flu at the moment is at extraordinary levels, and we haven't seen this for quite a number of years at this high level. And coincident with, of course, the other viral infections means
now the question of who should get the bivalent booster or even the basic vaccination. I mean, should everybody, irrespective of age, however young the children might be, is there a positive boon for them or for those around them?
So I suppose if you take it at the one that's been most recently approved, which is the vaccination of under 5-year-olds, the benefits there are both direct to the individual, the child themselves, and indirect to the family and their wider kind of social circle, because we know that children are at low risk of disease, but it does occur. We want to keep the families well, we want to keep the individuals well. So if you have a sick member of staff, mum, dad, granny, and you have somebody who's under 5, those direct impacts for the child themselves are that they have a better chance of dealing with this infection themselves. And nobody wants to be that low risk case of having a child that could have had a less serious disease had they been vaccinated. Yeah. Or granny or granddad who might pick it up from the child and end up having kind of serious complications. So it's not as clear as it is with the older age groups. For the older age groups, it was really crystal clear, keep you out of hospital, keep you from getting serious disease. And if you did get into hospital, if you were vaccinated, you were in a much better state than if you were unvaccinated. So it's not quite as clear cut as it is in the older age groups.
But still, there are benefits. All right.
Oh, there are benefits. Absolutely. If it was my own children, if they were that young enough, I'd be marching them down to the nearest vaccination centre and giving them. So I'll put my cards on the table for that, with respect to that. But I vaccinate my children against practically anything that's going. So I suppose I'd be a bit unusual in that regard.
Liam, thank you very much for joining us. Liam Fanning, who's Professor of Immunovirology at UCC.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.